B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, January 5th, 2018. And a note to my listeners, I've decided not to continue with the Friday Facebook Live video feed for a variety of reasons, mainly because the audience was not actually growing, and people didn't get the idea that I wanted you to call in and argue with me. But I will find other ways to be present on Facebook, and you can just watch for that without warning. It could happen at any moment. So yesterday, a flurry of activity in Washington, D.C. that produced pushback, particularly from the state of California and other coastal states. Because without any warning, Ryan Zinke of the Interior Department hopped off his horse and announced that they are going to open every bit of American coastline, just about, to offshore drilling. Now, it's interesting, the first governor who piped up and said no way was Republican millionaire, maybe he's a billionaire, I don't know, but he's a capitalist pig, Rick Scott of Florida. Because of the blowout in the Gulf, the Deepwater Horizon, Florida is still recovering from the impact of that massive oil spill from an offshore platform. And here in California, we have dark memories of 1985, Santa Barbara oil rig blew, and more recently, a pipeline right on the California coast burst and caused significant damage on a beach in the same general region. And we have had long-term opposition by both Democratic and Republican governors of California to any renewal of offshore drilling. And as a sailor, I have navigated and had to dodge the oil drilling platforms that remain off the coast of Santa Barbara, cluttering up the coast, putting the tourism and fishing industries at risk, and the general environment. And of course, all of this, you know, just flies in the face of the climate change and global warming issues and the need to keep that oil where it is, under the sea. There is no good rationale except profiteering for this announcement from the Trump administration. And the left coast governors, Brown of California, Brown of Oregon, and Inslee of Washington State, issued a joint statement blasting the Trump administration for this shift. Also, Democratic Governor Roy Cooper of North Carolina called drilling a critical threat to his state's economy. The Obama administration, which, you know, was very disappointing when it came to energy issues. Obama paid lip service to climate change, said that it was this great threat and he cared a lot about it. But despite the 2010 blowout in the Gulf, most new permits that were applied for under Obama were approved. Now, there was an effort to block drilling on about 94% of the outer continental shelf. But the Gulf of Mexico, I guess, is considered a fertile field for further exploration. Also, yesterday, as I mentioned in the News and Comment podcast, Jeff Sessions, the alleged attorney general, issued a memo lifting the restrictions that had been imposed in the Obama era on federal prosecutors going after marijuana cases in states where there is medical legality or adult use legality. And in response, there was uniform rejection from leaders in California. Gavin Newsom, who is our lieutenant governor, he led the effort to write the ballot measure that legalized adult use of cannabis that was passed last year and went into effect on January 1st. He said, there's no question California will ultimately prevail. The public has accepted legalization's inevitability. It will be very difficult for Sessions to bring us back to a mindset that existed 5 years ago or a decade ago. And Lori Ajax, the head of California's new Bureau of Cannabis Control, said that this is going forward as planned, consistent with the will of California voters. Now, 57% statewide approved Proposition 64, and in liberal counties like mine, the margin was like 71% in favor. And despite all this bluster pushing back on the federal government, and I fully support it, leaders across the state, including at the local level, have dragged their feet. It took 20 years to implement the rules for medical marijuana after voters approved that. And despite the pre-planning and the obvious 12-month lead time that they had to build the systems here in California, it's pretty pathetic, really. And people who want or need to exercise their legal right to access cannabis still are mostly relegated to the black market. And of course, Sessions is not just misguided because of his own bias. But the real issue is the opioid epidemic. Nobody overdosed and went to an emergency room because of pot last year. But some 60,000 Americans died in overdoses related to opioid abuse. And so these are misguided priorities from a deeply misguided attorney general. And one of the other wrinkles is this is grandstanding in many respects because here in California, the Trump administration has not appointed federal prosecutors. They required all the U.S. attorneys to resign, but they have not replaced them. And we also even hear from the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, that opioids are their top priority and that they really are spread too thin to go back to marijuana enforcement. There are also the very serious internal problems at the DEA that have been exposed by 60 Minutes and the Washington Post, particularly related to opioids, and how the manufacturers and distributors have gotten away with massive profiteering as they have pumped millions of these addictive pills out to pharmacies for public consumption. And the hands of the DEA have been tied by the leaders of the DEA and by measures passed by Congress. The other revenge or payback item that we reported on yesterday is the plan here in California to basically neutralize the impact of part of the Republican tax bill that was rammed through at the end of December. This relates to whether or not we can deduct state and local taxes. And I mentioned yesterday that the average in California deduction for state and local taxes is a whopping $22,000. That's now capped at $10,000, so it's a tax increase for most Californians who will have to now pay tax on the $12,000 difference because that $12,000 is not deductible. And the scheme here in California is to say that, well, after you've reached the $10,000 cap, any other money you pay to the state of California will be treated as a charitable contribution. Now, the state is a nonprofit. Some years it's worse than others. But in the Empire State of New York, Governor Cuomo has a different end run on the new tax package from the Republican Congress. And this gets a little complicated, but bear with me. He wants to eliminate the state income tax on wages. That would put more money in worker paychecks and mitigate the loss of full deductibility of those taxes on the federal level. That revenue would instead be raised by a statewide payroll tax paid by the employers. And that is still a legally deductible expense on their federal taxes. The state would then make employers whole through a tax credit or some other mechanism, and in theory, the only loser would be the federal treasury. Now, one of the things that really rankles me, doesn't wrinkle me, it rankles me, is that the Tea Party conservatives say, look, the reason for this is not payback to blue states that didn't support Trump. They're sending a message to these states to lower their tax rates. But of course, these low-tax proponents never talk about the impact. How do you pay for basic services like public education? Like roads and bridges? Like health care? Like we hate regulation. We've got to remove all regulation, so government would be, you know, could be shrunken. But these are such empty arguments. Because it costs a lot of money to run big states like California and New York, and if you don't collect it in taxes, where are you going to get it? So I don't know if any of these moves will actually go into effect at some point, but they are interesting gambits to push back on the claims of lower taxes by Republicans. Now, we're told that progress is being made to end the Dreamer hostage crisis. Trump put over 800,000 American residents into a hostage mode when he announced that he was going to end the delayed DACA program. You know what that is. And this is supposed to take effect, I think, on the 1st of March or thereabouts. John Cornyn, the number two Republican in the Senate, said, "I think we're narrowing the differences." But my big question is, will the Democrats really stand up for the Dreamers? Or will they be forced, in my view, will they show the lack of courage and cave to Republican demands? Because the demands have increased and they have shifted as this extortion over hostages continues. And Trump has said, well, he needs money for the wall. We were told Mexico was going to pay for his wall, but we never hear about that anymore. He is suddenly demanding $33 billion in new border security spending, including $18 billion for more than 700 miles of new and replacement barriers. That's a quote from the Wall Street Journal. New and replacement barriers. So it's not all going to be a wall. And Republican Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma met with Trump at the White House yesterday, and it's clear that in private, Trump acknowledges that we're not going to have a wall from West Coast to East Coast along the southern border. Instead, they'll put up fences, do electronic security, maybe fly some drones, that sort of thing. And it'll be interesting to see how much the Democrats will compromise in accepting unnecessary border security. Lankford said people want to paint that it's some 2,000-mile-long, 30-foot-high wall of concrete. That's not what he means, and it's not what he tries to say. Well, that is what he says. And Trump tweeted, "The Democrats have been told and fully understand that there can be no DACA without the desperately needed wall at the southern border and an end to the horrible chain migration." This is another new demand. Chain migration is a really cynical term for allowing families to stay together when some member of the family emigrates to the United States. I know it worked for my Irish great-great-grandparents when they came to the United States in the 1850s and 1860s. And I don't wish to deny it to today's new immigrants to the United States. Why should you have to give up your family in order to become a resident or citizen in the United States? And he, of course, finds any terrorist event and tries to blame it on chain migration and, that guy who surfaced in New York a few weeks ago, who'd been in the country for 7 years. This becomes, an example of chain migration. I don't know how much the Democrats will cave, but I'm pretty sure they will. Also on the immigration agenda here today, there's a new report from the Department of Homeland Security. And you won't be surprised that searches and inspections of cell phones, computers, and other electronic devices of people entering and leaving the United States mostly at airports, have increased by 60% from last year. And I think for American citizens, this is a gross violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. We're basically told to sit down and shut up, and that airports and, you know, border zones are special. The Constitution only vaguely applies in those cases. Trump Co., through the Labor Department, has announced another assault on the Affordable Care Act. And they're following through on plans to allow people to buy health insurance across state lines, which means that if you live in a state like California that has pretty strong regulations to protect healthcare consumers, you could buy a really crappy policy from Alabama, Texas, or some other right-to-work state. Not only that, they are reauthorizing the use of association health plans. And for example, I could form a group of podcasters and say it's the American Podcaster Association, and you join for $100 a year, and it enables you to buy some really lousy health coverage in what may ultimately be a scam. Because history has shown that these associations have left employers and employees with hundreds of millions of dollars of unpaid medical bills. And one investigator who exposed insurance fraud at the Labor Department for more than 20 years, said the proposed rules were an invitation to more scams. It's going to be beautiful, said Trump. You're going to love it. Oh, yeah. Every day I like to pause for a moment and thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. $5, $10, $20 a month. People like Kevin Beckley, Pauline Nixon, Susan Lewis, Gary Batterson, they've all been staunch supporters here, and I'd like you to join them. Just come over to peterbcollins.com. There's a menu button no matter what device you use. Click on that. Look for Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page. You get the options, $5, $10, $20 a month. The $50 annual subscription is a screaming deal. And don't forget, we have the Peter B. Collins app available for your Apple device, and it's in the App Store. On your phone or your iPad. And I mentioned yesterday that if you've got one of the new Alexa devices, these robots that you talk to and ask it to do things for you, just give it a try. Ask Alexa to play the latest Peter B. Collins podcast for you. And let me know if she balks, will you? She did it first time and very fast when I asked her. So we have new leak-based stunning reports from the New York Times. And as I dive into this new report by Michael Schmidt, I want you to note that the corporate media and the promoters of the Trump-Russia scandal narrative are quietly moving the goalposts. No longer do we hear about collusion so much. The claim that Russia hacked the DNC, and that's a fact, is fading. The claim that the DNC hacks were then leaked to WikiLeaks and weaponized to be released in an effort to defeat Hillary Clinton, that's also fading. And it's being replaced by two themes, corruption and obstruction of justice. And I have believed all along that Trump is corrupt. He is corrupt with Russian characters, Russian players. And it's been clear since he threatened and then fired James Comey, the FBI director, that he is engaging in some sort of a cover-up. And while Democrats have just gone off a cliff headlong behind the Russia, Russia, Russia stuff, from day one, Trump has been impeachable. And the real issue is not that we need Bob Mueller to produce this smoking gun. We need Democratic leaders to call for impeachment. That's the way to get rid of Trump. Because no matter what Bob Mueller finally reports out from his special counsel investigation, you got to do something about it. And you can't really indict and convict a sitting president. The mechanism is impeachment. And you hear all these Democratic leaders from Pelosi to Schumer complain about Trump and, you know, he's unfit to serve. But they have actively blocked the activists in the Democratic Party who have passed or attempted to introduce resolutions of impeachment. So the new Michael Schmidt New York Times report is damaging. It's additional evidence, if it pans out, because this is based on leaks. Leaks from people who apparently were interviewed by the Mueller investigators. And what we're learning is that Trump gave firm instructions last March to the White House counsel to stop Jeff Sessions from recusing himself from the Russia investigation. And he complained, like a mafia don, that he didn't understand that his job as attorney general was to pull out all the stops, legal or otherwise, to protect the president. So Trump ordered Don McGahn, the White House counsel, and he did follow up and had a talk with Sessions. Sessions recused himself anyway. What we're also learning is that a White House lawyer in the same time frame advised Trump that he shouldn't fire Comey because it's not clear that he had the legal authority to do so. And I have to tell you, going back to Watergate, I thought that the reforms to the FBI director position did give that person some protection from being fired by the president, and apparently that's not true. But the lawyer in question did offer advice to Trump, and his name is Utom Dhillon. Last name is spelled D-H-I-L-L-O-N. Now, Dhillon, once upon a time, worked at the Justice Department under a guy named James Comey. So you can raise obvious questions about whether he had a bias and whether he, you know, exercised that bias in his advice to the president. Now, you can make the case that Utom Dhillon was giving higher priority to the interests of the United States and the American people and the Constitution than to the advice that the president requested. And I haven't seen any Twitter activity today, but I would imagine Trump is hopping mad about Utom Dhillon, and it's hard to imagine that his White House pass will be working on Monday. But it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out. So Trump, as I mentioned yesterday, by issuing this cease and desist order to the publisher of Michael Wolff's new book, has simply generated millions of dollars in free publicity for Michael Wolff's new book. And now the media outlets that helped create the Trump monster, like NBC, MSNBC, CNN, they're all just reveling in the juicy gossip that has been disclosed by Michael Wolff in his Kiss and Tell White House book. And the latest today from Wolff on the Today Show, he said everybody in the White House views Trump as a child. Quote, what they mean by that is he has the need for instant gratification. It's all about him. He confirmed the rumors that Trump doesn't read. Quote, this man does not read, does not listen. He's like a pinball, just shooting off the sides. Echoing a column in the Hollywood Reporter, Wolf said certain members of Trump's staff eventually came to the conclusion that he cannot do this job. I'm talking about Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, whose real name is Ivana. The K is just a nickname. That their decision to work in the West Wing is a deep legal quagmire. Well, I don't know that that's the case because nobody's tried to make an issue out of it, at least not so far. He thanked Trump for helping him sell books. And when Trump tweeted that he had never spoken to Wolf and had authorized zero access, Wolf countered, I absolutely spoke to the president, and it certainly was not off the record. Now, Steve Bannon is the guy who's most widely quoted in the excerpts of the Wolf book that we've seen so far. And he's paying a price that he may not have expected. because Bannon has essentially forced people to choose between one egotistical dickhead or the other. And with a loose Bannon like Steve Cannon, oh, I think I blew that. With a loose cannon like Steve Bannon, his sugar daddies, Rebecca Mercer and her daddy, and Sheldon Adelson, have very explicitly and publicly announced that they are cutting ties to Steve Bannon. And word has been confirmed today, again, based on anonymous sources, people who presumably spoke to FBI investigators, that the FBI sometime recently resumed its investigation into the Clinton Foundation. The operations being run out of the FBI's field office in Little Rock, where the Clinton Presidential Library is located. And we're told that they are simply resuming the investigation that was suspended in 2016. And the Washington Post says it was suspended because Justice Department officials were concerned that if details of the probe were to become public, it would appear that they were trying to hurt Clinton's chances in the election. Now, there are two ways to interpret that. Either they were committed to neutrality, they didn't want to be seen as tipping the election, or they were committed to burying the information about Clinton to make sure that Trump didn't win. So, of course, pushback from the Clinton Foundation, a statement. The Clinton Foundation has demonstrably improved the lives of millions of people across America. Now, could somebody detail that for me? I'm not aware of any significant investments or grants that the Clinton Foundation has made in the United States. I've seen them bungle the relief efforts in Haiti. I've seen them do actually good work in Africa. But I'm not aware of any operation in the United States. Now, as you've heard me say before, I believe that the Clinton Foundation is ripe for investigation. The fact that Doug Band was running the Clinton Foundation and a company, a lobby shop called Teneo, simultaneously, is a problem. That's compounded by the fact that Huma Abedin, Hillary's brain, was on the payroll of the State Department, the Clinton Foundation, and Teneo all at the same time. And during that time, when Doug Band called over to the State Department and said, hey, take a meeting with the Crown Prince of Bahrain, Cheryl Mills made sure that it happened. That's pay to play. There's also the documented example, documented through the emails that have been released, that Sid Blumenthal, who was getting 10 grand a month from the Clinton Foundation, kept peppering Hillary with emails promoting business deals that he would profit from. And Joe Wilson, remember him, the husband of Valerie Plame back in the Bush administration? She was outed by Scooter Libby and also by Richard Armitage. I think he was the primary exposer of Valerie Plame. At any rate, Joe Wilson was able to lobby Hillary Clinton for $60 million from a State Department fund that was used to build a power plant in Tanzania. I'd like to see that fully investigated. But can we rely on today's FBI to do that job and to do it in a fair manner? No, I'm not so sure. The name Reality Winner has become a bit of a household name. She is the woman from Georgia who dropped some classified information to The Intercept, and The Intercept bungled it and helped expose her to the FBI. We covered last week the issues related to her interrogation by FBI operatives. And over at Shadowproof, Kevin Gostola has a good update on how the government is trying to prosecute her under the Espionage Act, which is so black and white that there is no weight given to what her intentions might have been, whether or not the release of the information that she's alleged to be responsible for had any impact or damage to the national security. No, the Draconian Espionage Act just basically says, if we can prove you did it, That's all that matters. The defendant's motive for conduct is irrelevant. Here in California, I told you earlier this week about the latest FBI frame-up of a domestic terrorism suspect. This is the case of 26-year-old, his name is Jameson, Everett Jameson. He's from Modesto in the Central Valley of California, and yesterday a federal grand jury in Fresno indicted him for attempting to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization, the Islamic State, and with a second felony, providing information about making bombs to an agent he believed was working for the Islamic State. But there were two paid FBI informants who were put on his case, and there was a paid informant, a snitch, who we know has done it before, who was paid $2,600 to expose Everett Jameson for some posts that he made on Facebook that we're told endorsed the Islamic State and terrorism. But I'm very curious why a man who lives in Modesto would be indicted in Fresno. Modesto is closer to San Francisco and to Sacramento, and there is a single federal judge in the courthouse in Modesto. He's known as the Gallo Court because Ernest and Julio Gallo persuaded Senator Alan Cranston back in the 1980s to add a federal district court and a single judge in Modesto. I will continue to ask questions about this case. Many of my listeners are familiar with Pacifica Radio and its flagship station in Berkeley, California, KPFA. I know some of my subscribers, like Terry Paris, are deeply involved in trying to keep KPFA alive. And it appears to be a losing battle at this point. I hope to be wrong about this. But the predatory capitalists are out there, and they have a $1.5 million judgment against Pacifica Radio, $1.8 million, sorry, for unpaid lease money on the transmitter site at the Empire State Building for its sister station, WBAI. And Pacifica has a great mission. There are many great people who've been on the Pacifica radio stations. Some still are. But internally, it's been a mess, subject to squabbling, infighting, mismanagement, failure to honor the fundamentals of running a business, like completing audits in time. They're 3 years in arrears of their pension payments. And as of Monday, the creditors have the right to seize assets of any Pacifica facility. And the one that has the most value in terms of real estate and the FCC license is KPFA in Berkeley. I hope they find a way to survive. It really saddens me to see this develop this way. And finally, earlier this week, in his 17 tweets in one day, Trump appeared to be joking, and he said that he was going to announce his nominations for the most dishonest and corrupt media outlet of the year. And in a tongue-in-cheek copy of the Oscar ads, you know, for your consideration, Comedy Central and the host of The Daily Show, Trevor Noah, have taken out a full-page ad submitting The Daily Show as a nominee for the most dishonest and corrupt media award of the year. And they have some juicy quotes here. Political propaganda disguised as entertainment. That's attributed to Breitbart News. Isn't The Daily Show a fake news show? Fox and Friends. Trevor Noah is the anti-Trump hack. That's from the Rebel Media. Monotonous liberal dogma. That's from the New York Post. So I like their sense of humor. Thanks for joining me today for my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it with absolutely everybody. Please do. And you can find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.